The presentation of anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual, of the human race. The emancipation.
Anarchist Essays is brought to you by Loughborough University's Anarchism Research Group. For more information on the ARG, see the link in the show notes or follow us on Twitter at ARGLBORO.
Direct Action, The Invention of a Transnational Concept by Sean Skelmer. This is an edited version of an essay published in full in the International Review of Social History, Volume 68, Number 3, 2023. The concept of direct action emerged into prominence over the last decade of the 19th century and the first decade of the 20th century. The transnational emergence of the concept can be most easily traced in patterns of publication. Pamphlets bearing the title Direct Action were regularly published in several languages. Émile Puget's pamphlet of 1903, Arnold Rohler's of 1907, William Troutman's of 1912, for example. Journals and newspapers bearing the title Direct Action likewise appeared in these years in France, Belgium, Germany, Norway, and Australia. And Direct Action was also the credo of Italy's leading socialist editor at this time, Enrique Leone. The rise of the concept is perhaps most fully expressed in the affiliation of radical institutions. In the first years of the 20th century, direct action was formally embraced by union and radical bodies across Europe, the Americas, Asia, and Australia. The transnational reach of the concept was explicitly recognised in a public invitation to the International Congress of Anarchists in Amsterdam, 1907. This justified the event partly on the basis that direct action had, quote, been strongly and consciously inaugurated across several countries in the recent past. The importance of the concept has not been overlooked by earlier scholars, and many studies of anarchism and syndicalism discuss direct action in some depth. Nonetheless, three historical puzzles persist. First, meaning. Though the term direct action was widely used from the early 20th century, there was no agreement on precisely what it meant. This was partly a reflection of conservative caricature, for in their efforts to stymie radicalism, its opponents associated direct action with a range of apparently malign behaviours, violence, terrorism, assassination, and even murder. This provoked confusion. Such associations were in many ways inaccurate, for influential supporters of direct action explicitly rejected a necessary connection with violence. But the situation was more complex than willful misrepresentation by a few critics, for many champions of direct action also freely admitted that the practice might extend to such violent behaviours as, quote, economic and social terror, pillage and arson, and bombs and dynamite. There was no consensus, even among enthusiasts. A second puzzle relates to novelty. For many, perhaps most, direct action was perceived as something new. Peter Kropotkin called it a new birth. Other supporters spoke of a new idea, a new means, a new tactic, and a new tendency. But this view was also contested. Many advocates of direct action were keen to imagine it as a long-term feature of popular struggle, rather than as a recent response to industrial modernity. Quote, it is no novelty, said the syndicalist. Supporters of direct action like Charles Albert suggested that it had been, quote, the tactic of anarchists while ever there have been anarchists, end quote. Writing in Le Temps Nouveau in 1907, Michel Pierrot pushed this back further, arguing, quote, direct action has always existed, end quote. Later historians of anarchism and syndicalism have not resolved this conflict, rather reproducing positions earlier advanced by the activists of several generations ago. Direct action has been treated by some as a new presence in the early 20th century, and by others as an old idea or practice. Further investigation is therefore necessary to clarify the form and extent of any alleged novelty. The third puzzle concerns the relationship of direct action to the nation. Many activists, French and otherwise, foregrounded the French identity of the concept. French examples and events were commonly invoked in treatments of the tactic, published in the USA, Australia, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Latin America. Important French writings on direct action were translated into Italian, Spanish, German, and English. French champions of direct action proclaimed their influence on neighbouring labour movements. But evidence also points in other directions. Many non-French pioneers of direct action were also commonly identified. Among them, the Italian Malatesta, the Russian Kropotkin, and the German Siegfried Nacht. And in the pages of the global labour press, exemplars of direct action were identified in spaces as diverse as Milan, Chicago, the London docks, Spain, Belgium, Germany, and Japan. In my article in the International Review of Social History, I seek to explain these three outstanding puzzles around meaning, novelty, and nation. I pursue these tasks sequentially, first clarifying the problem of meaning and only then considering the issues of novelty and nation. In trying to solve these problems, I offer the first sustained analysis of the transnational invention of direct action. I offer an edited version of this exploration in the rest of my recorded essay. To start with the puzzle of meaning. If direct action was subject to a variety of definitions, then its meaning cannot be clarified simply by their inspection and comparison. This merely establishes a terminological contest. It does not contribute to its resolution. A long-standing approach to intellectual history associated with the so-called Cambridge School and also with Reinhard Koselleck's Begriffsgeschichte provides methodological guidance. Broadly, these authorities suggest that fundamental or basic concepts do not possess a fixed or agreed meaning and that the meanings attributed to concepts shift over time. They stipulate that the historian should focus not just on the meaning of terms, but on their use, on the agents who use a given concept and on their varying situations and intentions, on the process by which given principles might be used to justify or enable action, and on the relationships between given words and broader vocabularies. Following these methodological strictures, it is possible to discern three principal ways in which activists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries used the term direct action. These three uses are analytically distinguishable, though they were sometimes practically intertwined. They could be called the categorical, the performative, and the strategic. Categorical uses specified a relationship to the state. They aimed to distinguish between political actions that worked through the institutions of the bourgeois state and those that did not. Used in this sense, direct action was action without any intermediary and, quote, without the intervention of representatives. It was contrasted with electoral struggles, voting, state action, legislation, parliamentary action, and parliamentarism. Used in this categorical fashion, activists sought to elevate direct action as more effective than its alternatives. Indirect action was depicted as slow and uncertain, quietist and fatalistic. Conversely, direct action was presented as more immediate, self-reliant, and efficient. Though clearly presented as an alternative to parliamentary politics, when used in this categorical fashion, direct action still remained a relatively abstract concept. A tactic, a means, a way, and a method, to use some of the terms deployed at the time. On occasion, the term could also be used in more specific and focused fashion. This was a performative use of the concept, and it did not simply signal a broad orientation to the state. It also referenced a cluster or repertoire of specific political performances. Advocates named or labelled several public performances as versions of direct action. These included, most prominently, the strike, the boycott, the trade union label, stump or soapbox oratory in public space, public demonstrations, cooperative experiments, and sabotage. But these examples are only indicative, and many activists attempted to expand the possibilities further. Some argued explicitly that direct action should not be considered, quote, a fixed thing, a thing that never changes, end quote, rather suggesting that it might be enacted in any number of ways. When its promoters used the concept of direct action in this fashion, they embedded it in attempts to incite contention and to enlarge the possible range of political performance. Advocates aimed to encourage greater and more diverse forms of struggle, to nurture apparently novel contentious acts, to insist on their political efficacy, and to posit a family resemblance between them. Framing these interventions as direct action help to fulfill these aims. A third strategic use of direct action did not address a relationship to the capitalist state or a particular repertoire of performance. It related rather to an excess of temporality. Used in this strategic fashion, direct action was posited as a means of connecting immediate struggles for reform and long-term aspirations for evolution, of bridging the present and the desired future. The form and importance of this use of direct action are best appreciated when placed in a broader intellectual context. Over the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the workers' movement was divided by often bitter debates over the possibilities of reform and their connections to revolutionary change. These were most obviously expressed in the debate triggered by German social democrat Eduard Bernstein. Famously, Bernstein rejected the notion that capitalism was bound to fall into imminent crisis, or that socialist tactics should assume such imminence. He advocated rather for the priority of political organisation, quote, to fight for all reforms in the state which are adapted to raise the working classes and transform the state in the direction of democracy, end quote. Bernstein thereby imagined a new relationship between the immediate and the ultimate, with the struggles of the present elevated above more distant hopes. Quote, that which is generally called the ultimate aim of socialism is nothing, but the movement is everything, end quote. Bernstein's arguments were partly based on a close observation of English trade unionism and its sympathetic portrayal in the Webb's book Industrial Democracy. They therefore had implications for debates around the relationship between immediate and long-term struggles among European trade unionists. In practice, nearly all trade unions were necessarily concerned with the winning of immediate demands. This posture was widely shared and even championed by trade union leaders in Great Britain and the United States, and by many socialist leaders on the continent. Conversely, many self-proclaimed revolutionaries deprecated the political possibilities of day-to-day union struggles. They presented such actions as a desire for, quote, amelioration rather than socialism, and as returning few advantages for the efforts expended. These arguments would be most famously developed in V.I. Lenin's critique of economism, What is to be Done, where Lenin diagnosed the limits of trade union struggles and prescribed a new kind of revolutionary party. But many of those who departed from Lenin's prescription shared his diagnosis. Notable supporters of the general strike typically drew a distinction between what were called partial strikes for limited aims and revolutionary strikes that sought socialist transformation. French anarchist Fernand Pelloutier, a leading propagandist for the general strike, denied the possibility that the partial strike could achieve anything meaningful at all. Contributors to Francisco Ferrer's Spanish journal, La Huelga General, agreed, arguing that, quote, utilitarian or reformist strikes could deliver only, quote, apparent triumph, lost time, and painful casualties, end quote. These prevailing and polarized viewpoints exposed revolutionaries were working within the trade unions to acute tensions. Moderates presented them as, quote, adversaries of all reform, or as dreamy utopians, unwilling to recognise the value of practical action. This was not conducive to the winning of union elective offices or informal influence with the rank and file. But an immersion in day-to-day struggles was also dangerous ground. Adherents of anarchism and socialism were anxious to maintain fidelity to a transformative vision and not to exchange their hopes for a new order for the paltry promise of what they called, quote, a thick sandwich for tomorrow, end quote. Caught between these opposing forces, radical activists working within the union movement sought to use the concept of direct action in a distinctive and strategic manner. They used the concept of direct action to commit themselves to immediate struggle for improvements, but also to claim that these struggles possessed a revolutionary content. The concept of direct action was a means of vaulting the binary between revolution and reform. Leading members of the Confédération Générale du Travail first articulated this position in a report to their 1903 Congress, subsequently published as a pamphlet, Grève Générale Reformiste et Grève Générale Révolutionnaire. Here they denied that there was a, quote, fundamental opposition between expropriatory and reformist forms of the general strike, since both, quote, rest on a common principle, the direct action of the working class, end quote. This strategic use of the concept of direct action was widely embraced at this time. Also in 1903, editors of the inaugural issue of the Parisian journal, L'Action Directe, argued that direct action was both revolutionary and, quote, the best means of being truly reformist, end quote. This was allegedly because reforms were only obtained by, quote, intense struggle and not by begging. In successive issues of this journal, contributors agreed that direct action straddled the apparent division between revolutionaries and reformists. As leading propagandist Emile Puget put it, quote, reform and revolution are not exclusive and are simply phases of action of differing intensity, end quote. By 1906, this position had become hegemonic within the French trade unions, registered in the CGT's famous Charter of Amiens, with its affirmation of the import of both, quote, immediate ameliorations and of preparations for the, quote, complete emancipation of the worker, attainable only with capitalist expropriation. Distinguishing between the different uses of the concept of direct action also clarifies what I have called the problem of novelty and the problem of nation. The different uses of direct action, that is, the categorical, performative, and strategic, each implied a different history and a different connection to activists in France. Categorical uses of direct action were evident from at least the early 1890s. Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin's English language journal Freedom referenced, quote, direct revolutionary action, end quote, in this categorical sense in 1890 and 1891, and, quote, direct action in 1893. Kropotkin also wrote of, quote, direct struggle in the French anarchist journal Le Temps Nouveau in 1895. Though the exact vocabulary was not always used, earlier contributions to international socialist debates often drew a categorical distinction between actions oriented towards the bourgeois state and actions separate from and antagonistic to state institutions. Writing in the early 20th century, Dutch syndicalist Christian Cornelissen argued that when considered in this wider sense, the concept of direct action was present from the early 1870s. Anselmo Lorenzo's reconstruction of Spanish contributions to the First Internationale, El Proletariado Militante, also emphasized the importance of a self-consciously anti-statist current in the early 1870s. There is no evidence that the French were especially precocious in the categorical use of this concept. Considered in performative terms, direct action also had a relatively venerable and transnationally dispersed history. Each of the major performances associated with direct action were used and promoted outside France long before the rise of direct action as an explicit concept. Moreover, the most prominent advocates of direct action, French and otherwise, publicly recognized these earlier histories and drew explicit attention to important precedents. Such a public acknowledgement is evident with regard to those performances most commonly identified and promoted in the first writings dedicated to direct action. These are the performances of the strike, especially the general strike, the boycott, the trade union label, and sabotage. This does not mean that French radicals of the late 19th century made no decisive contribution to the invention of direct action. On the contrary, they made important contributions to both the performative and strategic uses of direct action. These contributions took two significant forms, what I have called assembly and what I have called strategic articulation. Through these two activities, French radicals connected previously disparate political performances, embedded them in a strategic path to revolution, and promoted this new combination across the world. These efforts were central to the invention of direct action as a transnational concept. The key performances associated with direct action had long and spatially dispersed histories. However, before French interventions in the late 19th century, these performances were not understood as a connected repertoire capable of winning revolutionary transformation. When radicals outside France promoted and enacted performances like the strike, the boycott, and the label, they did not conventionally present these as an integrated means of seeking transformative change. They did not promote sabotage at all. Those labour movements that most fully deployed the strike, boycott and label tended to understand them as discrete performances for limited gains. The strike was conventionally framed as a singular event that did not imply complementary activities. As one contributor to the Bulletin International Anarchist explained, workers in countries like England did, quote, not understand quite enough the importance of action in a strike, end quote. As German socialist Robert Michels lamented, the German unions increasingly followed the English example. At times, these methods were even presented as alternatives rather than as complements. Though each of these performances had its champions, few argued for their common identity and mutual reinforcement. It was only in the process of crossing into France in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that they were more deeply intertwined. That process of enlacing was accomplished in three analytically separable stages, spread out over a number of years. First, sabotage was introduced as a complement to the boycott and the strike. At the French Trade Union Congress in Toulouse in 1897, the report of the Commission on Boycotts presented sabotage as, quote, a tactic of the same essence as the boycott and a, quote, indispensable complement to the boycott. A resolution passed at this Congress noted that in situations in which, quote, the strike was not able to deliver the results workers sought, end quote, they should apply, quote, the boycott or sabotage or the two simultaneously, end quote. No previous formulation had presented these methods as a connected means of struggle. French campaigners did not invent these performances, but they were the first to identify them with each other and to advocate the possibility of connected use. Second, a commission at the Trade Union Congress in Paris 1900 explicitly introduced the union label as an addition to this triumvirate and further justified the label as a complement to the boycott. As it argued explicitly, quote, the trade union label is tightly connected to boycotting. The two systems which seem to be diametrically opposed have the great virtue of leaving from two different points and of arriving at the same goal, end quote. In this way, over successive trade union congresses, French unionists declared adherence to the strike, the boycott, sabotage, and the label, and further proclaimed their common bases. Third, in the aftermath of these formal Congress decisions, French propagandists began to explicitly frame the joint performance of the boycott, the strike, sabotage, and the label as sharing the common identity of, quote, direct action. Influential advocate Emile Puget, a key figure on the 1897 Commission on Boycotting, led the way, describing these four performances as versions of direct action in his influential pamphlets Le Syndicat, 1904, Le Parti du Travail, 1905, Le Confédération Générale du Travail, 1908, and in contributions to journals such as Le Mouvement Socialiste. Other union and anarchist journals also took up this formulation, though sometimes dropping the label from the triumvirate or substituting a more generic etc. for performances beyond the strike, boycott, and sabotage. This understanding of direct action as an assemblage or repertoire organised around three key performances, and sometimes expanding to include others, soon became hegemonic. This status was both reflected and reinforced by Georges Iveau's ABC Syndicalist, praised as, quote, the practical manual of syndicalism, printed in tens of thousands, and the most widely read of all syndicalist works. Iveau emphasised that, quote, direct action varies according to the circumstances, end quote, but in his discussion of the methods of action and direct action, gave pride of place to sabotage, the boycott, the partial strike, and the general strike. In this way, through a process of intensive discussion and decision-making within the French labour movement, activists established that direct action possessed an agreed performative core. A repertoire of direct action was publicly named and its first defining elements agreed. The contribution of French radicals to the invention of direct action went beyond these important interventions. The French did not only connect previously disparate performances under the concept of direct action, they also embedded these interventions in a strategic discourse, so that the performance of direct action was understood as a revolutionary act. This process of strategic articulation was enacted in three primary modes. First, French activists persistently framed the performance of what they called direct action as revolutionary in character. This partly involved the generous application of the descriptor revolutionary to the term. Direct action was described as, quote, revolutionary, the revolutionary method, and revolutionary action. But key performances were also framed in these terms. The boycott was said to possess, quote, revolutionary roots. It was conceded that the label, quote, is not in appearance a manifestation of revolutionary flamboyance, but equally insisted that it, quote, derives no less from the same principle, the workers' struggle to defend themselves against capitalism directly and by their own forces without resting on an external power, end quote. Second, the strategic and revolutionary character of direct action was explicitly justified in argument. It was explained that performances like strikes and boycotts and sabotage were revolutionary because they trained workers in the methods of struggle and they inspired workers to future rebellion. Campaigns for wages were described as, quote, preparatory struggles for a future revolution, stimulating in participants, quote, the idea of revolt. Direct action was described as educative, a school of revolution, a school of will, of energy, of fruitful thought. The metaphor of gymnastics was sometimes favoured, with the performance of direct struggles like strikes said to enhance the fitness and capacity of the working class, thereby equipping them with the ability to overthrow the existing order. Third, many propagandists for direct action also posited a political sequence through which strikes, boycotts, and sabotage would be broadened into a revolutionary general strike. The CGT's Commission on Strikes and on the General Strike, 1903, was the most influential and early articulator of this view, suggesting that, quote, a series of ever-widening conflicts, end quote, would propel the workers' movement from, quote, reformist strikes to a, quote, final revolutionary general strike. But in succeeding years, many other propagandists, among them Hubert Lagardelle and contributors to Le Temps Nouveau, echoed this expectation. Émile Puget perhaps expressed this standpoint most fully. In his history of the CGT, Puget argued that, quote, partial modes of action, such as the strike, boycotting, and sabotage, were, quote, prodromes, or early symptoms, of the expropriatory general strike. Going further in his jointly written utopian text, How We Will Make the Revolution, Puget and his co-author and leader of the Electricians' Union, Emile Pétaut, imagined a future revolution as the outcome of a series of interlocking acts, a strike in the building industry met by police repression, sabotage, a general strike, the seizure of workplaces, trade union organisation of production, the use of the boycott against parasites and exploiters, and then a final triumph. This vision of revolutionary transformation was, of course, not universally accepted, but its account of the revolution growing out of a series of smaller manifestations of direct action was certainly the object of discussion. It was these French interventions which forged direct action as a new and basic concept of labour movement politics. Though the French movement was no vanguard in the winning of industrial victories, the writings of its key activists spread widely. As one contributor to the German anarchist journal Der Revolutionär put it, French propaganda moved, quote, not the mass of their fellow countrymen alone, but rather crossed the borders and awakened an echo in the hearts of the exploited of neighbouring lands, end quote. French debates on the general strike were frequent points of reference in Spain and Italy. This included pamphlets produced by the CGT, speeches by French socialists, and texts written by French union leaders, such as Puget, Yvot, Griffels, and Pétaut. Émile Puget was translated and reproduced in English, Spanish, and German. His work circulated in North and South America, and he was even quoted at the key IWW convention that marked a decisive turn away from party politics. Puget was also a frequent presence in the pages of pioneering Italian journals of syndicalism, Il Devenire Sociale and Pagine Libere, accompanied by the writings of other French activists and intellectuals. Argentinian activists, for their part, reproduced key congresses of the French CGT in their weekly La Protesta Humana, emphasising, quote, the importance of the new tactics, end quote, that the French imparted. They underlined the French origins of key direct action tactics, such as the general strike, and they deployed the French spelling of other performances, such as boycottage and sabotage, signifying the French influence. The import of the French assemblage is perhaps most fully expressed when tracking transnational discussions of direct action. In the aftermath of French interventions, radicals in other countries began to reproduce the French formulation, framing the strike, the boycott, sabotage, and often the label as the core of a direct action repertoire, sometimes suggesting further performances, imputing direct action with a capacity to make revolution. The reproduction of this assembly, often though not invariably with reference to French authorities, is strikingly evident across Europe, North America, South America, and beyond. And I trace this process in some detail in my longer article in the International Review of Social History. Through intense intellectual effort, transnational exchange, and creative and often courageous political struggle, the concept of direct action was thus forged and popularized. It crystallized as a central element of anarchist political debate and practice, as well as a feature of radical politics more broadly. Of course, this moment of invention is only one period in its broader history. The concept of direct action would be remade and reimagined in subsequent years in the context of new struggles across the world. And that is a transformative practice that continues today.
Thank you for listening. To help others find Anarchist Essays, please rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts. And if you're interested in anarchist ideas, why not check out the journal Anarchist Studies? For over 20 years, Anarchist Studies has been publishing original research on the history, theory, and practice of anarchism. For more information, visit www.lwbooks.co.uk/anarchist-studies.